You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Order! Order! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all here today, those in the audience who are with us, but also those coming in over webcast and over C-SPAN as well. So we're very happy to have C-SPAN here. We welcome you for a conversation on the role of Parliament in policy and politics at a crucial moment in one of the best friends of the United States and our closest ally, the United Kingdom. This past year has been a series of extraordinary developments in British politics, with the House of Commons at the center of it all. A particular interest has been the long-running debate over the country's departure from the European Union, in which there have been three defeats of the government's Brexit deal and two extensions of the deadline. Last week, the UK, along with the rest of the EU, held elections for the European Parliament, and the country will soon have a new Prime Minister. A leadership contest is getting underway within the governing Conservative Party following Prime Minister May's announcement that she will step down from party leadership following President Trump's state visit and the D-Day commemorations next week. With all that as background, we're particularly grateful and very honored to have with us today the 157th Speaker of the House of Commons, the Right Honorable John Bercow. Speaker Bercow began his parliamentary career in 1997 when he was elected the Member of Parliament from Buckingham as a Conservative. He served on the front benches as spokesman for education and employment and home affairs starting in 1999 and was appointed Shadow Secretary to the Treasury in 2001, Shadow Minister for Work and Pensions in 2002, and then Shadow Secretary of State for International Development in 2003. Now, he was elected Speaker in 2009 and has served in that role ever since. Mr. Speaker, we are delighted to have you at Brookings with us this morning. As you may know, Mr. Speaker, Brookings has undertaken a major study of the challenges and the pressures faced by democracies today. And I think I can speak for this institution in that your role as the Speaker of the House of Commons, in that role, you are indeed a forceful voice in defense of liberal democracy in the world today. You've spoken powerfully about the rule of law, about respect for human rights, and the imperative of civility. And on my own, I would simply say people in this city ought to be listening to all that very closely. And he's done it all while keeping order in the House of Commons. Today's event is part of the Brookings Robert Bosch Foundation Transatlantic Initiative, or the BBTI, as we call it, a multi-year project of applied research and programming that seeks to reinvigorate and, more recently, to preserve the transatlantic collaboration on global issues. Events like this would simply not be possible without the partnership that Brookings has with the Robert Bosch Foundation, and we are deeply grateful for that continued support. So in a few moments, I'll invite Speaker Bercow to the stage for his remarks. And after that, Thomas Wright, who is a Brookings Senior Fellow and the Director of the Center for U.S. and Europe here at Brookings, will moderate a conversation with the Speaker and Amanda Sloat, who is our Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center for U.S. and Europe as well. Questions and answers will follow their discussion. And a final reminder, we're very much on the record today and we're streaming live. For those of you coming in over the internet, we're most grateful for your attendance. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honor and pleasure to welcome to the BBTI stage Speaker Bercow, and I look forward to his remarks and to the subsequent conversation thereafter. Sir, please join us.
President Allen. Well, it has a certain ring to it. It has really to be acknowledged. I'm bound to begin by observing, my friends, ladies and gentlemen, that Having heard myself introduced, I can hardly wait to hear myself speak. Whether you'll feel the same way at the end of my remarks is a matter for legitimate speculation and conjecture. But in the interests of inclusiveness, of intelligibility, of ensuring that everyone here present can genuinely attend to and feel a part of the proceedings, perhaps I can begin by inquiring whether you can hear me at the back. Well, there are expressions of assent and even some modest arm waving by one gentleman wearing a splendidly picturesque tie, upon which I congratulate him. And I take that as a modest encouragement that he is content to be able to attend and to hear. And that response, if I may say so, my friends, to my inquiry, can you hear me at the back, represents a marked improvement upon the last occasion upon which I posed that selfsame question to an audience, can you hear me at the back, in which some unhelpful wag replied, yes, but I'll happily change places with someone who can't. So maybe I should quit while I'm ahead. It's encouraging to know both that you can hear me and that you do not appear to be altogether distraught about the fact that you can do so. Let me, if I may, not because I want this to be a mutual admiration society, but because I believe in candor and straightforwardness, respond to you, John, by saying that for me it's an honor and a privilege, as I said, on the doorstep of the institution. Never would I have imagined that the day would come that I would be invited to address the Brookings Institution. I've just had breakfast with the British ambassador, Sir Kim Darroch, and your ears would have been burning, those who lead and those who have scholarly positions at the Brookings Institution, if you'd heard what he had to say. He said the Brookings Institution is a stellar performer, hugely revered and esteemed for the sheer quality as well as the prodigious quantity of its output. The amount you do, the focus on genuine research, on scholarship, on interaction and interplay of ideas, and on ensuring that there is at least the prospect of evidence-based policy is something that should be commended to one and all. There aren't many institutions that have quite the cerebral representation that Brookings has, and I think that that is something to be respected, and it is to be recognised by anybody invited to be amongst your number, even only for a short period, that that is a very considerable honour. As far as Amanda is concerned, I don't want unduly. I use that helpful qualifying term, unduly, because it's my get-out clause, to embarrass Amanda, but I will own up to you, ladies and gentlemen, I've got friends across the political spectrum, as you would expect in the United Kingdom. I did some work with and for Ed Balls when he was Secretary of State for Children, Schools and Families in the Brown government, and Ed and I have been friends for way over a decade. I've got the highest regard for Ed, and I spoke to Ed and mentioned my interest in coming to the United States and in the possibility of having an academic gathering. And he commended Amanda to me in terms that brook of no misunderstanding. He said how much he liked her and all the rest of it, and they'd cooperated on a number of fronts. But very specifically, he said to me, John, the thing you've got to understand about Amanda Sloat, apart from her very, very great knowledge of the European issue, is that she has a brain the size of a planet. So I hope that she will bank that. It's now recorded. It's on permanent file. And she will deploy it to her advantage in times that lie ahead. Now, before I address some serious matters to the best of my ability within the time frame available to me, I do want to treat of one quite sensitive matter. which I hazard a guess your natural courtesy will probably disincline you to raise with me directly, but which, if unaddressed, will lurk mischievously, and perhaps from my vantage point, ladies and gentlemen, perilously, in the undergrowth, and which I conclude, therefore, must be knocked on the head at the outset before I further proceed. And that is the sensitive matter of height. Very specifically, it has been bruited. I rather like that old-fashioned word. In some of the more down-market parts of the media, that I am the shortest man ever to be Speaker of the UK House of Commons. Let me say to you, let me assert with all the conviction and rhetorical force at my command, and for the avoidance of doubt, that there is nothing wrong with being short. On the law of averages, the likelihood is, though I know not to whom this description applies because most of you are seated, that a significant number of you in this audience share that characteristic of vertical challenge with me. We may be short, but we may also be, judge ourselves to be, and be judged by others to be, perfectly formed. In any case, we're environmentally friendly in that we don't take up a great deal of space. Moreover, I am by way of making a virtue of necessity, my friends. I am short. I have always been short. I'm 56 years old, and therefore I'm set to remain short. And indeed, given the known impact of the aging process upon physiognomy, the overwhelming likelihood is that I shall become inexorably and irrevocably shorter still. And about the fact of that continued and soon to be exacerbated shortness, I'm as intensely relaxed as the Svengali of New Labour in the United Kingdom, Peter Mandelson, once famously, or in some people's minds infamously, observed that New Labour was intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich. But I'm not intensely relaxed about the matter of historical accuracy, and simply as a matter of historical fact, it's quite wrong when some of these more down-market, low music hall, fifth-rate scribblers say, oh, well, Burko's the shortest man ever to be Speaker of the UK House of Commons. Sir John Bussey, Speaker of the UK House of Commons, from 1394 to 1398. Sir John Wenlock, Speaker from 1455 to 1456. And Sir Thomas Tresham, Speaker of the UK House of Commons in 1459, are all believed to have been shorter than I am, although I do have to admit that this was true only after all three of them had been beheaded. Indeed, no fewer than seven of my predecessors met their end on the executioner's block. One was killed in battle, and a further poor unfortunate soul was brutally murdered. So you will understand that this does enable me to view the woes and challenges which afflict and confront the House of Commons, which afflict and confront the British body politic more widely, and which, in all candour, I readily concede, periodically afflict me, with an appropriate sense of historical perspective. That is to say, whatever else happens to me, I am not likely to lose my head, despite occasional rumours to the contrary. That was a fate that sadly befell speakers in the eras that predated the emergence and confirmation of British parliamentary democracy. And that concept of British parliamentary democracy is my starting point. As Gladstone observed in the Sebastopol speech in 1855, February the 23rd, 1855, the business of the House of Commons is not to govern the country, but to hold to account those who do. Now, of course, in our system, there is a marked difference from that of the United States. We do not have a separation of powers in the same way. And as you will readily recognise, in Britain, members of what I call the executive branch, that is to say, ministers in the government, do sit in Parliament, indeed in both Houses of Parliament, predominantly in the House of Commons and in smaller numbers in the House of Lords. But just so you are clear, beyond peradventure, there are roughly 80 ministers, it varies, in the House of Commons. That is to say, government ministers in the House of Commons. But there are 650 members of Parliament. So well over 550, nearer to 570 members of the House of Commons are not part of the executive branch. And their responsibility is to question, to probe, to scrutinise, to challenge, to contradict, and even from time to time, to expose the errors of omission or of commission of the government of the day. They are not there purely, and in some cases they don't see themselves there for this purpose at all, to do what the government wants. They are constituency members of Parliament, they deal with casework, they take up local concerns, they study policy, they assess legislation, they seek to better it, and to challenge and probe and hold to account the executive branch as that branch discharges its duties. The role of the Speaker in the British system is, of course, very different from that in the United States. I have the highest regard for and quite a long-standing link with Speaker Pelosi. But in the British system, the Speaker isn't a party player. The Speaker is, from the moment of election, required, I was going to say exhorted, nay, required thereafter to eschew party politics, to renounce affiliation. And the Speaker, though a constituency MP, sits as a quasi-independent, and the Speaker is independent of, unconnected with, owing no allegiance to, and expressing no support for any political party. My role is to umpire the proceedings, or to serve as a referee, if you prefer that term. I am, if you will, the leader of the Good Order and Fair Play Party. My responsibility is to try to facilitate the House so that all the different points of view can be expressed. I keep order, I encourage people to take part, and I try to cut down on the number of people excluded altogether as a result of bad behaviour. So you can see where the analogy with a referee or an umpire, and sometimes even perhaps with a teacher or a head teacher in a school, kicks in. In addition, I have a responsibility to select amendments to motions and amendments or new clauses for debate and vote where legislation is concerned, and periodically to make procedural rulings, as I did back in March, when I simply wished to signal to the House that, alongside a variety of other considerations, an important consideration was the preservation of and therefore continued respect for the notion that parliamentary time should be properly used, that the decisions of the House should be respected, and that colleagues should not be continually exhorted, berated, or harangued into taking a position on a matter upon which they had already pronounced. And that's why I said on March the 18th, the so-called same question rule, the rule that says the convention that decrees that we don't have the same question put, or substantially the same question put, twice in a session, was important. And if the government wanted to come back to the House of Commons and to put a different proposition to that which it had previously put in relation to Brexit, it would be perfectly in order for it to do so, and it subsequently did so. But simply to press precisely the same case would run the risk of falling foul of that important, hallowed, and overwhelmingly complied with convention. Let me, if I may, just make three further points and then hand over for a wider discussion. First, as Speaker, my principal and overriding concern over nearly a decade in the chair has been to try to ensure that the business of the House is livelier, more dynamic, more unpredictable, more urgent, more topical,
more geared to the focus on discussion of and expression of different opinions about those matters that preoccupy our electorate. For a long time, that was not the case. The government controls the order paper, that is to say, the principal business of the House each day. This government does, its predecessor did. This is not a party political point. But the provision in our standing orders that allowed matters to be raised if they were considered by the chair to be urgent had long fallen, before I was elected in 2009, into desuetude. And so specifically, the provision that said that members could apply to the Speaker to ask an urgent capital U, question capital Q, of a government department was almost held in abeyance. It had ceased to be. In the year before I was elected Speaker, only two urgent questions, typically then running to 20, 25, 30-minute exchanges in the House, probing the government on some matter that had just arisen, about which there was a controversy, where there was an inconsistency, where there was a change of policy, where there was a scandal or an embarrassment to be explained or defended. That wasn't happening. And I said, well, if you elect me as Speaker, I'm determined to revive and to preside over a renaissance of the mechanism of the urgent question, which will be a magnet for colleagues to come to the chamber rather than appearing in radio stations, television studios, or penning blogs. They'll have an incentive to come to the chamber because they can raise that which is urgent. And it will be a means by which ministerial feet can be held to the fire. Now, whether I'm a good speaker or not is not for me to say. I obviously feel I can do the job, and presumably my colleagues do, because I've been elected and re-elected a total of four times. But ultimately, no person can be judge in his own cause. Others must judge that. My central thesis to you is simply that I've done what it said on the tin, and I have granted 618 urgent questions over the last just under 10 years, facilitating a vast number of members to raise a vast number of questions on a vast miscellany of different issues spanning virtually every government department. And the best ministers in each government tend not to complain. If I may say so, Jack Straw in the Labour government, Secretary of State for Justice at the time, never cavilled at or remonstrated with the decision by me to grant an urgent question, because Jack was a man of government, but he was also a parliamentarian. And he wanted to attend to the criticisms of his position and to respond. And in the present government, if I may say so, I would cite Michael Gove and Jeremy Hunt as very good examples of extremely capable ministers who've got the intellectual self-confidence as well as the communication skill and the dexterity at the box, as we call it, the dispatch box, to cope with that which is thrown at them. So sometimes people complain that the Speaker has granted an urgent question, but neither of those two has ever, in my earshot, complained. They're people who know that they can hack it. So that's been my approach to the business of the chamber. More widely, I've thought it relevant, this is possibly of less interest to some of you, but important to me and to a lot of people in Parliament, to try to make the House of Commons more representative of the country we're charged to represent. And specifically, therefore, I thought it a priority, out with the chamber, to make the Palace of Westminster somewhat more modern. So that's why I thought, well, it's ridiculous when I took office. We've got a shooting gallery. You can go pistol shooting in Parliament. But you can't put a baby anywhere because we don't have a nursery. Well, 10 years on, I'm pleased to say we no longer have a pistol shooting gallery, but we do have a very well-subscribed nursery, which was a prize project of mine early on. I thought it ridiculous, and I looked somewhat enviously at the United States, which, of course, has a wonderful visitor centre in Washington, that we didn't have an education centre. And it was a priority for me to establish a digital, high-tech, interactive, cutting-edge, state-of-the-art facility adjacent to the House of Lords, to which in due course 100,000 young people a year will come to learn about the journey
from 1215 and the signing of the Magna Carta to the rights and responsibilities which British citizens enjoy today. That centre is oversubscribed as week after week after week school children come to see what goes on. And that, to me, is a source of pride. We want to bring people into our democracy, not repel them from it. So those were what you would call second-order issues. They're not legislative first-order issues, but they're issues about the culture of the place, as I think it's also relevant that we've got more women in senior positions, and I've made a particular point of appointing more women and more BME citizens of the United Kingdom to prominent positions as Speaker's Chaplain, Speaker's Counsel, Sergeant-at-Arms responsible for chamber security. There's a lot more to do, but those are the changes that have been made. The last point I want to make to you, and then I'll sit down, is this. The Speaker has to avoid party controversy. The Speaker, however, can be an ambassador for Parliament and a robust advocate of democratic politics. And when I stood for election, I said to colleagues, I do not intend to dress up in a fancy uniform day by day and to remain incarcerated in the Palace of Westminster, completely inaccessible to the outside world. If you elect me, I will try to be a speaker not just in Parliament, but a speaker for Parliament, a speaker who welcomes people to Parliament in the state rooms and hosts charitable functions 3, 4, 5 times a week, and a speaker who gets out and speaks to schools and to universities and to faith groups and to charitable institutions, and a speaker who welcomes the United Kingdom Youth Parliament every year to Westminster, to the green benches to conduct their debates of their choice, and a speaker who goes as a matter of pride to their conference every single year. I promised the UKYP that I would go to their conference every year to talk to and hear from them. And the reason why I have always taken that stance and I have honoured that pledge is partly, of course, I enjoy it. You'll say, oh, well, Burko, generally speaking, is generally speaking. He enjoys speaking, so that's why he does it. Well, there's an element of truth in that. But the reason otherwise why I do it, ladies and gentlemen, and I would like to commend this to you, is that I feel that if ever we in Westminster and politicians in other great democracies want again to be respected by young people, we have to show respect for young people. Respect is not our automatic right. It's an earned credit or a two-way street. Enough from me, notwithstanding your quite extraordinary courtesy and forbearance, ladies and gentlemen, my friends of this august institution and from wider civil society, you will be mightily relieved to know that my speech is now definitively at an end.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for fascinating remarks. I think you'll find that we're being broadcast on C-SPAN, but you are must-see viewing, I think, in the United States over the last 2 years. People we've heard all the time have been fixated on parliamentary questions and the parliamentary process, and I'm sure we'll find out later. You may get some relatively detailed and arcane questions on the procedures in the House of Commons. But I wanted to just start. We are sort of in an extraordinary situation. You know, Britain's likely to have a new prime minister. The various candidates are sort of outbidding each other and what they'll do on Brexit. It's sort of unprecedented that the government has not had a majority for its sort of key piece of legislation for the last couple of years. And we really want to sort of unpack that and also look at your reflections on your time as Speaker. But before we get into that, I'd like to turn to Amanda, who's done a lot of work here on Brexit, for sort of her reflections on your speech, and then maybe we could proceed from there. So, Amanda.
Well, we're delighted that you are here. Great that you were able to join us. I appreciate the kind remarks in front of my boss. And as Tom has said, I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of interest in Brexit here in Washington. There's also been a huge amount of confusion. So part of what I have tried to do is to explain some of the arcane parliamentary politics to an audience here. And so we were even more delighted that you were here to explain the arcane process to us in person. I think what I was most struck by, and perhaps a place we could start, was interested in getting your thoughts on your role and on the role of the Parliament. You yourself clearly came into the job with a very clear vision for how you wanted to operate as Speaker. A number of things that you talked about having changed. An author of a biography about you, I saw, says that you changed the job, and so interested if that was part of your intention going in. The Sun, and I think other tabloids less hospitably, called you Speaker of the Devil, which maybe you embrace that as a positive. But was interested in hearing more on your remarks about the way in which you saw that. I think there was questions here about the role that Parliament had in shaping the debate, your role in choosing which amendments were able to go forward, your role in choosing who was able to ask the questions, your role in going back to parliamentary precedent from 1604, and I've personally been curious if you just have an arcane knowledge of parliamentary procedure or whether you have particularly clever staff, in terms of making some of these rulings that really ended up being quite essential in the way the debate played out, and then more broadly the role of Parliament in this process, because it has been quite striking over the last couple of months, and it's what you were referring to, how central Parliament and the legislature has come in this debate over Brexit. One of the questions that I have been asked by people here is, you know, whether this process is undemocratic. Should May, for example, have consulted more? Barnier was consulting quite widely with member states. So I don't want to put you on the spot specifically with your assessment of the Prime Minister. But more generally, are there lessons to be learned from this experience of Brexit in terms of the way that Parliament itself functions? So many things there. You could respond to what you want, but very interested in how you saw your role as Speaker, how you performed some of these very specific functions that ended up being quite influential in the debate, and then much more broadly, what we can learn about the role of Parliament generally in these processes.
Well, Amanda, thank you very much. You've wrapped up a lot of important issues in those remarks, to which, you know, briefly I will try to offer an initial response. Yes, it hasn't been accidental the way I've gone about serving as Speaker. And although you adjust a bit the longer you're in office and new challenges emerge and you can be on the receiving end of good advice that might cause you to take a slightly different direction, I think I can honestly say that although I couldn't possibly have anticipated the Brexit situation when I stood for election as 2009, I was clear in my own mind then that there was a problem for Parliament. And specifically, Amanda, Thomas, colleagues, my assessment of the situation back then was that, quite aside from the reputational carnage inflicted by our expenses scandal, there was a much bigger, more enduring challenge for Parliament. And that was, put very simply, over decades under governments of both colours, the power of government had increased, was continuing to increase, and needed to be decreased. Of which the corollary was that the power of Parliament had decreased, was continuing to decrease, and needed to be increased. In other words, I felt, ladies and gentlemen, that there was a disequilibrium within the British body politic a decade ago. I don't say that that's gone. It would be extraordinarily presumptuous and arrogant to say that it's a case of job done or that I have been able to reverse that trend definitively or decisively. I don't make such a claim. But I do argue that the way I've gone about the job is to try to allow the House of Commons, I've no say in relation to the House of Lords, to breathe. And yes, as a private citizen, I have my own views on a range of issues, but it's not really about what I think on individual issues. It's about what Parliament's role should be. Now, virtually every speaker at some stage is criticised for alleged partisanship in our country. His or her decisions are pored over, and people say, ah, that's evidence that he or she leans that way on this issue or the other way on this issue. So it's very hard to be free of the charge of bias. But it's in the job description of Speaker that you are neutral between the political parties, or impartial, if you prefer that word. Secondly, we're in an age of transparency where everything is trawled over, so if you weren't, you'd soon be found out. Thirdly, I used to work, as Americans would put it, I think, across the aisle. I used to work on a cross-party basis on speech and language and provision for children with special educational needs, the fight against global poverty, the pursuit of constitutional reform, the campaign for LGBT equality, etc., etc. I worked on those issues over many years on a cross-party basis, so I had long since ceased to be tribal, and I think I could fairly claim to be someone with links across the House. And I sat on the previous Speaker's panel of chairs that chaired bill committees and so on. So I don't think I found it difficult to be impartial. But I've not been impartial about the House. I'm impartial within the House, but not impartial about the House. And my feeling was, well, the Speaker has got to enable the different voices to be heard, whether they be, let's say, on Brexit, the voices of strong Remainers, or the voices of strong Brexiteers. And when the committed Brexiteers were in a minority on the Conservative benches under David Cameron, I stood up for their rights to be heard, to ask urgent questions, to probe, to amend, to try to scrutinise better the government of the day, because part of the Speaker's job is to speak up for or to champion the rights of minorities. And now, in a sense, you know, the Brexiteers are in the majority within the Conservative Party. I'm not cavilling at that, I'm not knocking that or criticising that, that's just a statement of fact. But there are other views, and those other views are entitled to be heard. So my approach at question time, and when ministers deliver statements, or the Prime Minister delivers a statement to the House, is basically to enable everybody to be heard. And in that sense, you could almost say I'm rather undiscriminating. There's not an absolute rule about it, but statements, that is to say an announcement to the House by a minister, was typically followed in the past by exchanges lasting 45 minutes or maybe an hour. I sometimes run exchanges on statements by the Prime Minister for 2 hours or more. And I absolutely admit, ladies and gentlemen, I do it not out of any desire to make the life of the Prime Minister or the other minister concerned difficult, but because I feel these are momentous matters. And every voice should be heard. And if that means that we spend a bit longer, well, so be it. What other incredibly important business is more important later in the day than that the executive's representative, the Prime Minister or the Brexit Secretary or the Foreign Secretary or the International Trade Secretary, should be fully, yes, painstakingly, remorselessly questioned and scrutinised? So I think sometimes when people say, ah, well, the Speaker called this one before that one, or there was a debate and this one got in early and that one got in late. Well, if I may say so, under my aegis, on my watch, I've made a priority of ensuring that far more people get in of all views. So, you know, I think I've been fair-minded. On the convention, the 17th century convention, look, I do have some clever people helping me. Did I have a sort of complete recall of that? No, I was aware of the issue and I did a little bit of research. And I saw for myself what had been ruled in 1604. And, you know, there were people who said, ah, what an old hat convention. But I argued that the absence of speaker intervention in relation to that convention was attributable not to the discontinuation of the convention, but rather to general compliance with it. In other words, the Speaker hadn't had to intervene because generally it had been observed. Now, originally that convention owed its foundation to abuse of parliamentary time, very often by backbench members, repeatedly introducing the same measure. And somebody did say to me, John, it wasn't introduced in order to frustrate the government of the day. And I said, no, but the general principle of equality should apply here. And if it is wrong for a backbench member repeatedly to press a case which has been, I use the term in the parliamentary sense, disposed of, that is to say, ladies and gentlemen, decided by the House, well, the same principle should apply to a government. And I've every respect for Theresa May, so it's not intended to knock her, but if a government has put a proposition and it has been dealt with in that session, you know, the idea that the same proposition should be put over and over and over again in the hope that the answer will change would not, in my judgment, be right. Now, as far as she's concerned, it's not for me to say whether she should have taken a different approach. The only thing I will say, I've every respect for her. She's made her decision to depart, and I think on a human level, anyone can identify with somebody who leaves a job before he or she wishes. And she's always treated me with complete courtesy, and I respect and appreciate that. I think the loss of the majority in 2017 at the general election made it very much more difficult for her. Now, you know, there will be people who say, oh, well, if after that a different approach had been taken, a different outcome might have been achieved, and we might not be where we are now. Well, you know, that's sort of speculative. And, you know, as to where we go from here, well, my own view about it is, A, we have to wait to see who emerges as the next Prime Minister, but you know, the appetite of the House to have its say has recently been whetted. And that appetite is not exhausted. Indeed, some would say it's voracious. The House will want to have its say. And the idea that the House won't have its say, you know, is just for the birds. Parliament is a big player in this, and that whatever view it takes, whether Parliament votes one way for one particular proposition or for a directly contrary proposition or for another proposition somewhere in the middle, remains to be seen. But the idea that Parliament is going to be, it may in due course, for reasons of restoration and refurbishment, be physically evacuated, but the idea that Parliament is going to be evacuated from the centre stage of debate on Brexit is unimaginable. It is simply unimaginable.
Just on that point, because I think this is a very sort of important point that people are looking at in the present sort of context, the candidates for the Tory party leadership are promising, several of them, to force through a no-deal Brexit on October the 31st if they can't renegotiate the backstop as part of the deal in Brussels, which most observers think is unlikely that they will get concessions that the previous Prime Minister did not get. Do you think that a Prime Minister committed to a no-deal Brexit can force it through? There's been speculation that, you know, if they're determined not to play ball with the House of Commons, that they can basically force it through, or that the Commons will sort of insist on a role and will be able to block Britain from crashing out of the EU on Halloween.
Thomas, thank you. My reading of the situation is that legally, the default position in the absence of an agreement, a deal, is Brexit on the 31st of October. That is to say, in the absence of a deal and in the absence of a further extension. That is the legal position as I understand it. There was a bill passed, ladies and gentlemen, under the leadership of Yvette Cooper from the Labour side and Oliver Letwin from the Conservative side, to prevent a no-deal Brexit. But I think I'm right in saying that piece of legislation, which was passed, is now OTOs, because it referred to a particular set of circumstances in April, and therefore it's been overtaken by events. So legally, the scenario, Thomas, that you highlight, and which you say is spoken to by a number of people who seek to be Prime Minister, that is so. There can, however, be a difference between what the law says and what political movement between now and then, political activity, decrees. And I'm not saying that Brexit without a deal will happen, and I'm not saying that it definitely won't. And I am saying, I'm very clear in my mind, that Parliament and individual parliamentarians will have strong views about these matters. And there is a difference between a legal default position and what the interplay of political forces in Parliament will facilitate. It's not for me, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand, please don't take umbrage at this, it's not for me to seek to claim to know what is the will of the people. It's not for me to seek to claim to know that. That's not a matter for the Speaker. My job is to stand up for the right of the House of Commons institutionally and the rights of individual members of Parliament individually to express themselves and to try to take policy forward as they think fit. So I think there is much debate still to be had, and the idea that there is an inevitability, I don't think anybody is saying this, or I'm not aware of it, but the idea that there is an inevitability of a no-deal Brexit would be a quite wrong suggestion. There is no inevitability whatsoever about that. Harold Wilson was not one of our greatest prime ministers in the UK, though he was a rather a canny operator. He fought five elections and he won four of them. And Harold Wilson's probably most famous adage was a week's a long time in politics. There's a long way to go. There's a lot still to be said. And, you know, nothing should be taken for granted. And, you know, it was said that we would be out of the European Union by the 29th of March and then by the 12th of April. And in due course, we may be on whatever basis we may be. But at the moment, the United Kingdom remains a member of the European Union and there is much debate to be had and policy to be determined and conclusion to be reached.
Thanks. Amanda, did you want to come in on this point?
Yeah, I was going to ask where this leaves the country in broader constitutional terms, right? We have a situation where a government lost a referendum that it brought, where the government has not had a parliamentary majority to be able to deliver on the results of that referendum. So I wonder if we're seeing tension between direct democracy, where the people were able to speak in a referendum, a parliamentary democracy where you have gridlock in Parliament and Parliament isn't able to deliver on that, and then also an executive that is not able to deliver on that. So interested in where you see this tension between direct democracy and parliamentary democracy, and then also more broadly, what this is likely to do to the country going forward. It seems now we've seen with the European Parliament elections, the two establishment parties, the Conservative, Labour, both had very bad elections. Increasing support for the Greens, for the Liberal Democrats, of course for Nigel Farage's is Brexit party. All parties arguably that had a much clearer stance on the position of Brexit. And so you have a very polarized country and a very polarized parliament. And so where the country, even in broader terms, is able to go forward with this, not to mention potential questions for Scotland, for Northern Ireland, when you have such deep divisions within the country.
Could I just underscore one element of that,
of course,
too? Because just the Britain never had a referendum before 1975. You know, it's the first ever referendum was on leaving the EU in 1975, and the government wanted to remain. And there's virtually been no, very few referendums since. There was the voting system referendum,
yes,
that the Conservatives basically won.
Yeah.
And then there was regional referendums in, sure, Northern Ireland and in Scotland. But, you know, as someone who sort of grew up reading a lot of British history, it was drummed into us that, you know, parliamentary sovereignty and sort of the Burkean notion of the MP was what really mattered, and direct democracy was this sort of European thing that led to the destabilization of Germany and other places. And I guess just in addition to Amanda's question, I would just ask, like, has Brexit sort of fundamentally undermined, does it fundamentally threaten the British system of parliamentary democracy? I mean, do you see a fundamental tension between having plebiscites and referendums and this institution that you are charged to sort of uphold its tradition and its sort of constitutional role?
I don't want to fudge it because it is an important issue, but there is scope, ladies and gentlemen, for nuance here and calibration, if I can put it like that. If you ask me, is there an automatic and sort of ineluctable incompatibility between parliamentary democracy and a referendum? The answer is no. There isn't an automatic and ineluctable incompatibility between the two. It is possible to have a referendum on a particular matter at a given time and for parliamentary democracy to continue to thrive, to prosper, and to be either to a greater or to a lesser extent unblemished by the experience. I think the truth of the matter is that there are very few absolutes in these matters. When the decision was made by the Cameron government to seek a referendum on Brexit, the term Brexit, ladies and gentlemen, by the way, for those scholars of these matters, had scarcely been coined at that time, but we know of what we speak. The issue was, should we stay in the European Union or not? Prime Minister Cameron, I think, was motivated by a number of considerations. There was a growth in the UKIP vote. He faced very considerable pressure within his own party. And he made the judgment that this was the right way to put the issue to bed. And there were a number of people who agreed. Indeed, I remember myself at the time thinking, well, there is an argument for it, because the matter isn't readily capable of resolution by normal methods, that is to say, parliamentary debate and elections. And the reason why it couldn't be treated in that way was that all of the major parties, Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat, were in favour of continued British membership. So a general election couldn't be the vehicle for sorting out the issue of Brexit. So I could see an argument for a referendum. I'm not sure, you'd have to ask David Cameron, that that was his motivation. I think he was very preoccupied with the challenges that his own party faced at the time, and he thought that this would be a way of overcoming some of those difficulties. I leave you to judge whether, in fact, the matter has been successfully resolved in the way that he envisaged and dearly hoped. My point, really, and forgive me if you don't regard this as satisfactory, but it is my point, is that the only duty of a Member of Parliament is to do what he or she thinks is right. Now, you may say, oh, come on, John, you know, I didn't come to hear you say that, but that is my honest view. So, there is a view that says the referendum supersedes anything else. Parliament, legitimately, not as a result of a mass rally or a sudden decision to hold a meeting a la a Greek city-state, you know, in Parliament Square, Parliament legislated for a referendum, and the referendum went in favour of Brexit against the wishes and, to a considerable extent, the expectations of much of what I will describe non-pejoratively as the British establishment. But that's what happened. And so there is a view that says, that's it. That's it. We didn't talk about having best of three or best of five. We didn't talk about ifs and buts or apples and nuts. We said that we would trust the people. Most members of Parliament voted for the referendum legislation across the House, not just on the Conservative side, across the House. And the referendum's happened. And that's the outcome. And our task is to deliver it. That is an opinion. Moreover, it may be that if a Member of Parliament flies in the face of that by voice or vote and says, no, I don't accept that, that Member of Parliament may face sanction within his party. I'm not making a party political point, ladies and gentlemen. I'm making a factual point when I invoke the example of my parliamentary colleague and county colleague, as it happens in Buckinghamshire, Dominic Grieve, who is a former Attorney General in the Cameron government, And Dominic is a strong Remainer, a Member of Parliament for Beaconsfield. He recently, it's not binding, but he recently suffered a no-confidence motion against him in his local party because he has said he thinks there should be a further referendum and he thinks that it's a great act of economic and political self-harm for Britain to leave the European Union. Now, he may, I'm not saying he will be, but he could end up being deselected, and that would be a matter of political judgment for his party. Or a Member of Parliament could fly in the face of his or her constituents and get kicked out of Parliament. Those are political matters. But if you ask me, is there a legal duty for an MP to vote for the result of the referendum or to vote against the result of the referendum, the answer is no. There's no legal duty at all. It's a matter of choice for the member. The member must decide what he or she thinks is right, right for the country, perhaps right for Europe or right for the world. And they may face consequences if they fly in the face of their party or their voters. But that's a choice that they can make. That's one point. And the second point with which I leave you in answer to this question is that I'm not arguing for or against. I'm simply making a factual point. The referendum legislation was in the 2015 to 17 Parliament. The referendum took place on the 23rd of June 2016. And Parliament then invoked Article 50, the two-year countdown to Brexit, and it did so in March 2017. Those are very significant matters. They are relatively recent decisions, and they can't just be wished away or sniffed at or said to be of no consequence. They are of consequence. But those matters were matters decided by the last Parliament. No Parliament can bind its successor. The most recent Parliament was elected on June the 8th, 2017. So this Parliament can do as this Parliament thinks fit. Now, you know, there might be somebody who will say, oh, well, Bercow's trying to signal that Parliament should do X or should do Y. No, Bercow isn't trying to signal that Parliament should do X or should do Y. Bercow is appearing at the celebrated and august Brookings Institution and trying to give an honest answer to a question. And if you ask me, you know, I mean, I admitted on one occasion, probably unwisely, but I admitted to speaking at Reading University a couple of years ago that in the referendum I had voted to remain. I admit that, and I'm not adding to or subtracting from that. That's a matter of fact. But if you ask me, am I unashamedly pro-Parliament? Yes, I'm passionate about parliamentary democracy. I believe passionately that Parliament must do what Parliament thinks is right. And you're absolutely right. You know your history. Edmund Burke, at one time the Member of Parliament for Bristol, famously said in his Bristol speech, as your Member of Parliament, I owe you not merely my industry, the old-fashioned word for hard work, but my judgment. And I betray instead of serving you if I sacrifice my judgment to your opinion. MPs, once they're elected, have a responsibility, not just a right, but a duty to do what they think is right in terms of voice and vote.
Thank you. So I think
it's great.
And I think we want to go to the audience in a few minutes, but we did, I think, want to look a little bit at the broader picture as well outside of the UK, because you became Speaker in 2009, right? And so, if I'm not mistaken, that was the sort of start of the financial crisis. And since then, we've seen this upswing in populism across the Atlantic and across the world, really. And so I guess, and I know, I think Amanda has a question here as well to add in, but I would just ask, how has the tone of politics really changed in your time as Speaker? I mean, you've been witness to this sort of rise in populism and divisiveness that we've seen across the world playing out spectacularly, of course, in London. So I'd be very curious for your reflections on that, but I wanted to bring Amanda in as well on sort of the U.S. angle to this too.
We are in Washington, so of course we need to ask a Trump-related question. President Trump, of course, is going to be in London next week for a state visit. He was there in 2017, and you blocked him from addressing Parliament during that time, citing opposition to racism and sexism, as well as the migrant ban. We did note that Xi Jinping did address Parliament in a state visit in 2015. So in your effort to allow and encourage free speech and debate in Parliament and encourage it among your MPs. We were interested in your criteria and why one and not the other?
Okay. Well, look, I'll deal with the second question first. No disrespect, yeah. Thomas, I shall come on to yours. Amanda, in relation to President Trump, the first point to make is that no request has been received by me for President Trump to address a gathering of both houses of Parliament in Westminster. No request has been received.
On the current trip? You mean for his
visit
next week?
No, that's quite true. Yes, in relation to the current trip. I did express myself on this matter on February the 6th, 2017. There was a certain amount of internal correspondence at that time, and it was certainly being considered at that time. I'm not sure whether it was a formal request. I don't recall receiving a formal request, but there was a certain amount of correspondence and discussion of it at that time, but it didn't happen. And I've nothing to add to or to subtract from what I said on February the 6th, 2017, of which you've just given a very eloquent précis. But in this case, no request has been received. That's the first point. The second point I think is worth making, because you are either academics yourselves or you take an interest in academic study, academic research and empirical evidence. There is a view abroad, and I use the term abroad in a political sense, that it is the unbreakable norm, the very established and hallowed convention for a visiting president of the United States coming to the UK to address both houses of Parliament. And if you'll forgive me saying so, this is not so. It is not in any sense an unbreakable norm or a hallowed convention. It has often happened, ladies and gentlemen, but it hasn't happened in every case. If memory serves me correctly, I wasn't in Parliament at the time, President Reagan did indeed address both houses of Parliament in the Royal Gallery, which is a very prestigious venue, but it is usually regarded as a slightly less prestigious venue than Westminster Hall. The fact is that President Obama was invited to address both houses of Parliament in Westminster Hall, and that was very well received. His address was very well received. He was a comparatively popular president in Europe, and indeed, as far as my colleagues in the House of Lords and I in the House of Commons could tell, in the UK. And he was also, of course, the first black president of the United States. And he was invited to address both houses of Parliament in Westminster Hall, and it was a great source of pride to me to welcome him on that occasion. His address was very well received, and to be honest, people to this day talk about how behind the scenes he behaved towards everybody he met. He wanted to meet every doorkeeper. He wanted to shake the hands of some of the most junior people on his private tour, which was not being filmed. And it was a very celebrated occasion. I think I'm right in saying that George Bush Sr. did not address both houses of Parliament in either of the venues that I've mentioned or any other, and George W. Bush did not do so. I think one of them came during a parliamentary recess, and whether there was a request made, I don't know. I wasn't in post at the time. But certainly George W. Bush didn't. So all I'm saying is it's not in any sense an unbreakable norm. And that's the second point. And then the third point, and in relation to the Chinese president, is a point very well made by you. And let me be absolutely honest with you. You know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, I had a sort of basic sense of how I wanted to operate as speaker, but you learn new things as you go along and you get new advice. And let's face it, you make mistakes. You do, you make mistakes. And looking back, do I think there is a powerful argument that says that perhaps the Chinese president should not have been invited to address both houses of Parliament? There is a powerful argument. I'm not saying it's conclusive, but, you know, if you say to me, well, John, you know, I'm not necessarily knocking you in relation to President Trump, but why did you think it right to allow the Chinese president's address. At the time, the Lord Speaker and I were persuaded that there was some merit. We were trying to develop that relationship. The Chinese president addressing us seemed not to provoke general consternation. That was my sense, and something I have to take into account. I had no sense that there was a general air of outrage amongst parliamentary colleagues at the idea, and it seemed to me to be a reasonable proposition. Was it necessarily the right decision? No, not necessarily, and I'm absolutely open to the idea that maybe, I should have come to a different view about it. But, you know, what is past is past. Somebody, I think, at one point dug up the fact that in 2012, the Emir of Kuwait addressed both houses of parliament, not, to be honest, in the Royal Gallery or Westminster Hall, in the most junior of the possible settings for such an address, in the roving room in the House of Lords, which is a much smaller room. But the Emir did. And I remember looking into it at the time, because I wasn't necessarily enamoured of the idea, and I was told on advice that by comparison with a lot of other countries in that part of the world, you know, his record was not particularly bad, and there was something to be said for allowing him to address us. Was I right about that? Probably not. But those matters are past, and, you know, we made the judgment we did. I was at an earlier stage of my speakership when the Emir of Kuwait decision was made in 2012, and then in October 2015. So I'm not sort of standing here or sitting here and saying, oh, I'm right about everything, and whatever I say, please agree with me. We're all open to criticism, perhaps coruscating criticism, and maybe I was wrong on those matters. I don't want to dilate on the matter of President Trump, but I've nothing to add to or subtract from what I said in February 2017, and, you know, nothing has happened since then. To cause me to change my mind, although, you know, some people might say, well, quite a lot of things have happened to cause me to remain of the same view, which is why I have nothing to add to or subtract from what I said on that occasion. As regards wider populism, put very simply, what do I feel about that? I am concerned about that. I mean, in one sense, I'm passionate about Parliament. I'm really proud of where the House of Commons is in terms of assertiveness and the sheer range of colleagues who speak up and speak out on matters dear to them. This is something that horrifies the government whips. Way back in 2011, I'm not saying this was the right thing, I'm just saying I tried to do the right thing by Parliament. 2011, the so-called Backbench Business Committee of the House, which was a reform I championed, decided to have a debate on whether there should be a referendum on British membership of the EU. Now, the government won the vote because the opposition, I think, voted with the government or abstained. I think they voted with the government. And the government won the vote handsomely against a referendum at that time. But what shocked David Cameron, and more particularly the government chief whip, was that a very large number of Conservative MPs rebelled against the government and in favour of a referendum. And I think there were 81 rebels. And over 50 of them were new MPs. Now, this was regarded as almost sacrilege. A new MP was normally expected just to be loyal and ambitious and to do as he or she was told. And the government whips were absolutely horrified at the idea that all these new MPs were voting with their consciences. But actually, I'm in favour of MPs voting as they think fit, whatever the whip says. You know, I always had a relationship with the Tory whips characterised by trust and understanding. I didn't trust them and they didn't understand me. So, you know, the idea of Parliament speaking for what it believes, I think, is a good thing. I must say that, look, there's no point in inveighing against technology. The development of more and more social networking sites, you know, in many ways it's a positive thing. There's a space for people to speak who aren't powerful or rich or established journalists, and that's a good thing in many ways. I do think that when I witness wherever, but let's take the British context, where I witness the sheer dumbing down and vulgarisation of debate and the replacement of the reasoned argument on an issue with the ad hominem personal attack, that doesn't exactly make my soul sing. I feel sad for Parliament and for politics, and I have loathed, and I use this word advisedly, I have loathed the development whereby people are subject for simply doing what they think is right or for being who they are. have been subject to the most venomous personal attacks. And a lot of people of strong opinions in our parliament have been denounced and attacked and excoriated and personally, viscerally, brutally, viciously abused simply for saying what they think. And there is, as a matter of fact, no doubt that women have disproportionately been on the receiving end of this abuse. Anna Soubry, previously a Conservative minister and a Conservative backbencher, now a member of Change UK, a very outspoken pro-EU member. Luciana Berger, who's also now a member of the Change UK party, but Luciana was for many years a Labour member of Parliament. Luciana Berger is a Jewish member of Parliament who's been subject to the most appalling racist abuse on social networking sites from the extreme right and the extreme left. And, you know, the list goes on. Ruth Smith, another Jewish member, has been attacked in this. This approach to politics and argument stinks. This has got nothing to do with genuine debate and everything to do with trying to threaten and bully and intimidate people out of the public square. And if I may say so, those who have reported politics as though people expressing independent-minded views, let's say on Brexit, are somehow malcontents, traitors, enemies of the people, have got a lot to answer for. We've got to be very careful to try to preserve that principle that we play the ball, not the man or the woman. Or to go back to Voltaire, you know, I disagree with what he says, but I defend to the death his right to say it. The idea that might is right, or that a vicious pen should suffice to silence a dissident, that is against every democratic principle and every notion of political pluralism, every concept of parliamentary representation, dear to me, and I think dear to people who cherish democracy. We should not have a situation in which those who shout the loudest or the most abusively get their way, because that way, frankly, lies ruin.
Thank you. Okay, so we have 15 minutes for questions. We're going to take three at a time, I think, and that allows you to choose which you want to answer. And you have to be
right.
You have to be short. You have to ask a question. And if you abuse that, you don't just get in trouble with me. You get in trouble with him. He's well used to dealing with difficult questions. Gentlemen at the very back.
Say whatever you want, whatever you want.
And say who you are, please, and then...
Hello, my name is Wyclef Beutin. I'm, in fact, a German diplomat working currently at one of the think tanks in town, CSIS.
You and the impressive tie.
Yes, I'm not asking the question to make my tie or indeed myself more famous today, but I am interested and want to continue on with a question that Thomas just asked and your answer to it. If you see this tendency that you describe of more split views, of more ghastly arguments, or not arguments, but rhetoric, I do understand the role of yourself as speaker, as umpire, but is it conceivable that you work more in a spirit of compromise to get members of parliament to work more in a spirit of compromise in the future, calling on them, doing anything else? Is it legally possible and conceivable politically? Because I think in a wider sense for Europe, maybe also over here, that's really something that we need.
Thank you. Let me see. The lady in the middle, sort of four rows up over here. Yes. Yes.
Hi, Alice Penny. I'm an assistant professor in European Studies at Johns Hopkins SAIS. Johns Hopkins University, yes.
Yeah.
My question is about the time-consuming effect of Brexit, and I'm wondering to what extent the activities in Parliament have been disrupted, the more mundane day-to-day political issues on which the country and the MPs have to vote, to what extent have they been disrupted by the Brexit process?
Thank you. And then one more behind you, the lady just behind you. Yes.
Una MacDonald, former British Member of Parliament, Mr. Speaker, but fortunately before your time, or not fortunately, before your time.
Forgive me, you said your name.
Una MacDonald.
Oh, Dr. Una MacDonald, Labour Member of Parliament for Thurrock.
Indeed, what a brilliant memory.
Rather a distinguished academic, are you not?
You read the list. Very wise to have come prepared. But my question to you is quite a general one, Mr. Speaker. How do you think you will go down in history as Mr. Speaker?
Okay. First of all, on the question of whether, you know, in the light of the growth of polemicism and contrarian politics or very personalised and vituperative politics, you know, there might be scope for and a likelihood of greater attempts to forge compromise. I think there's quite a strong chance of that, to be honest. It's not something the Speaker can decree. It's not something that it's really for the Speaker to seek to promote in any very forceful way. Why? Well, because whenever you take a position on something like that, you know, there are people who don't agree and who will say, well, you are effectively, even if in a benign way, even if in a well-meaning way, even if in a non-party political way, trying to call the shots as to how we debate. And so, you know, I don't. To give you a very simple example, ladies and gentlemen, one of the most common questions put to me is, Mr. Speaker, in Britain, why don't you intervene when X or Y or Z minister is clearly not answering the question, to tell that person to answer the question? And the answer to that is, I don't, because if I do, I'm in danger of becoming a player on the pitch rather than the referee of the match. And I tend to say to people, if it's obvious to you that the question's not being answered, well, it's obvious to everybody else as well, and people can make their own judgment about that. But actually, I call people to order really only if they are completely off the subject and therefore out of order in that, you know, they're not attending to the matter under debate, or if they're too long, be they minister or backbencher. You know, I'll often say, well, you know, the abridged rather than the War and Peace version would be appreciated. Or, you know, there's a late sketch writer called Simon Hoggart who accurately interpreted me when he wrote once in his column, when Speaker Burko says, I'm extremely grateful to the Honourable Gentleman, that broadly translates as, shut it, sunshine. And that's correct. And so it's not for me to decree that there should be more consensus seeking. Do I think there's quite a strong chance of that? I do, actually. I mean, it's not for me to take sides between, you know, different leadership contenders in a political party, but I've heard, you know, prominent people in recent days talk about the pursuit of consensus. And I know there are, so, you know, I mean, just to give a couple of examples, Michael Gove has talked about that, Jeremy Hunt's talked about that, but there are people on the Labour benches who would say that, and I suspect most of the leadership contenders would, on the Conservative side, would probably rather have more support in what is a very balanced parliament, effectively a hung parliament, than not, and I think there are lots of people on the other side. So it's a question of translating the aspiration for consensus into the determined pursuit of it. It's a bit like over the years, lots of leaders of opposition parties and prime ministers have said, I want to bring an end to Punch and Judy. I mean, quite a lot of American viewers might like Punch and Judy at Prime Minister's Questions, you know, the slugfest. But there is a view that says, let's have more rational discourse, less personal abuse, fewer attacks of a personality kind. But the trouble is, the competitivity between the parties is such that it doesn't always happen. The support bases tend to like the attack dog stuff. And so nobody really wants to start first. They're all in favour of peace, but not just yet. A bit like, you know, Augustine, make me virtuous, but not yet. Or not just yet. So, you know, I don't know whether that will happen, but I think there's a strong possibility of it. In relation to the second question from our friend from Johns Hopkins University, if I understood correctly, is other stuff being crowded out? Yes. It's not an act of deliberate policy by anybody, but the bandwidth, ladies and gentlemen, available for other matters to be treated of by the House is inevitably denied or restricted or curtailed because there are only so many hours in the day. So unless we sit for far more days in the year, well, inevitably, stuff that would otherwise be considered isn't considered. Is that a problem? I think most people, to be honest, across the piece would agree that that is a problem. that, you know, other matters are not getting the priority that they warrant. I don't blame that on any one individual or indeed on one political party. It's just a fact. It's a consequence, if you like. It's the collateral damage caused by the fact that as yet we haven't resolved the Brexit issue. I do think it is likely to be a short to medium term phenomenon, not a long term phenomenon. But is it a problem? It is. You've got to be careful what you interpret from it then, because there will be people who say, oh, I totally agree with that question, and that's why we've got to. People will interpret it to suit them. So people will say, ah, well, I totally agree. We ought to be talking about X and Y and Z, and therefore we've got to get this Brexit deal sorted. I'm sorry to say, you know, at the moment we're talking about the withdrawal agreement. The idea that Brexit will be done and dusted if there is a withdrawal agreement, or indeed a Brexit on the 31st of October, is, if you forgive me saying so, not realistic. There are years of debate ahead as to the contours of a future relationship in trade, security and wider partnership terms. So, you know, I think there is a big challenge. But yes, we've got a duty to use our time efficiently and to try to protect the parliamentary space for other issues, including issues, if I may say so, that affect majorities, of course, public service provision, but including issues that affect vulnerable minorities of the population. Parliament exists to protect them as well, so we've got to try to find a safe space and adequate time for those other issues to be aired, debated and policy developed. Now, as far as Una is concerned and her question, you know, how do I think I'll go down in history? Well, I'll certainly go down. I'll certainly go down. And I'm not sure. I don't honestly, Una, and thank you for coming. And it's a, you know, you and I don't know each other personally, but I know you were, as I say, the member for Thurrock before I think a certain Tim Janman sort of got in the way and took over. I've known Tim a very long time. I'm not sure he quite shared your cerebral approach to politics, if I may say so. Tim was quite a keen populist himself. I've known him a very long time, but he didn't share your cerebral approach to political discourse. I don't spend a lot of time fretting about my legacy, and people probably say, well, that's as well. I remember once saying in the House, I'm bound to say to the honourable gentleman, somebody had asked me about something on the internet, and I said, well, you know, I must say to the honourable member that I don't spend a lot of time looking at these websites, and somebody called out, very wise. So, you know, I just try to do the right thing. You know, I would like to be remembered as, I'd like to be remembered, if I'm remembered at all, you know, as a backbencher's champion, as somebody who stood up for the rights of ordinary parliamentarians to have their voices heard. And, you know, and I do feel, if you'll forgive me saying so, and even if you won't, that, you know, it's not for the Speaker to be the cheerleader for the executive branch. It's not the Speaker's job to make life easy for the government. It's not the Speaker's job to side with the Leader of the Opposition either and be a cheerleader for the Leader of the Opposition. But it is the Speaker's job to stand up for the rights of Parliament. And I've often been told, Una, you will have known him, I'm sure, but I've often been told very approving stories about Jack Wetherill, who was Speaker from 1983 to 1992. I better not quote chapter and verse because I don't have this completely proven, but I know it was said at one time that there was a prominent Conservative cabinet minister who was most irked and irritated by some of the decisions from the chair that Jack Wetherill was making. You will know, you will remember, that Margaret Thatcher never wanted Jack Wetherill to be Speaker. She didn't think he was one of us. She thought he was what's called a wet. And she wanted Humphrey Atkins, or other debonair character that Mrs. Thatcher rather liked, to be Speaker. But the House of Commons didn't want Humphrey to be Speaker. It just didn't want it. Amen. End of subject. And it wanted Jack to be Speaker, and Jack Wetherill became Speaker, and he ended up making some decisions which irked some Conservatives. He was a Conservative by background. And a senior Conservative went to see him and said to him, Jack, I'm bound to say that some of the decisions you're making are most disagreeable to the government. And I would remind you, Jack, Mr. Speaker, sir, that you are a Conservative, and you are a Conservative Speaker. And Jack Wetherill's response was to say, no, I'm not a Conservative. I gave up party affiliation on becoming Speaker, as this Speaker did. And I'm not a Conservative Speaker. I'm the Speaker and my job is to do what I judge right for the House of Commons. Good morning. And he opened the door, and that person left the room, and the door was closed. And, you know, to be honest, that's my attitude. I've got to do what I think is right. And if you're not robust enough to stand up for what you think is right, well, then, frankly, you're not fit to be Speaker. And as I say, I'm happy to be judged by people, and some people may judge me well, and some people may judge me harshly. The key question is, can you look yourself in the mirror? In my case, it's a pretty pug-ugly sight. But can I look myself in the mirror and answer yes to the question, have you behaved honestly? And the answer is, I have, and I do so. And so I can look myself in the mirror, however disagreeable the sight.
Mr. Speaker, thank you so much. I think we promised to get you out of here at 11:15 because we know you have another...
I don't mind taking
You can take a walk, because we had a couple of people who were...
I'm sorry to have...
Two people who are very patient here, so this gentleman here, this gentleman behind, and the lady here, and then we'll try to wrap in 5 minutes. We'll be very brief, please.
And I'll give you a reply.
Thank you. I'm Peter Shetley, retired from Brookings. One of the key requirements for a successful democracy is an informed electorate. I'm not sure we have that meet that requirement in the U.S. now. I don't know about Britain. What might be done to address that problem?
Thanks. The gentleman two behind you.
Thank you. I'm Joseph Colomer. I'm teaching European politics at Georgetown. And I don't see how you envisage a no-deal Brexit. Because even if the current proposal and agreement between Theresa May and Brussels is being rejected by the House of Commons, some decisions must be made on the same issues. So about whether or not to pay the bill, several billion euros presented by the European Union, what to do with European citizens in England, living in Britain, what to do with the Irish border, and then if there is no... If the deal is not accepted, then the House of Commons and the government, as you brilliantly said, must make a deal among themselves inside the, within Britain, right? And then the deal in Britain would be the deal with Brussels.
So no deal. We're just out of time. We have the question, I think.
The question is, if there is no legislative decision, I think the legal default is remain, isn't it?
We have the question. So the lady beside you, and then we'll go back to...
Okay, I'll give you a brief answer to each.
Julia Miniva, EGBN. How will the diminished U.S. Commitment to NATO influence any formation of your European armed forces to replace it or any other... diminished U.S. commitment to NATO, will it...
Diminished commitment to NATO.
So it's a NATO question, but it's a little bit outside of the speaker's.
And
view,
another
think,
question: what is your vision for your country?
Okay. And Mr. Speaker, if I could just bring in Amanda one final time, just if there's anything, Amanda, you wanted to underscore. I guess, Mr. Speaker, I would just add to one of the gentleman's questions on the first gentleman on the political system. I mean, in Britain, there's a first-past-the-post system, and I wonder if you have any sort of reflections on if you are facing into a general election, with very fragmented political system. Is it sort of outdated given all of this sort of, you know, indigenous fragmentation that we're sort of seeing? Amanda, did you want to...
On the fragmentation and pulling off the last one. See, it's always the last questions that are the hardest and you regret asking for. is on the future of the country, looking particularly at Scotland and Northern Ireland and whether Brexit is going to have longer-term implications for the constitutional integrity of the UK. Like we said, you can pick which of these many you want to...
Well, look, as far as the question of the electorate being fully informed is concerned, look, you know, we're always capable of improvement. You know, I'm not going to knock the people of the United Kingdom. The people of the United Kingdom can make decisions in general elections and in referenda, and they have regularly done so. But one is always hoping that one can broker a greater understanding and an increased awareness and an extended participation. And it's a huge issue, but my honest answer to you is that I would like to see much better a focus on the education of our citizens, and citizenship education in schools, in my view, would be rolled out across the country a very good thing. Just as we have sex and relationship education, just as we have some time spent on PE, physical exercise, just as most people would accept that there is a merit in giving a basic induction to people in simple financial concepts, you know, having a bank account, you know, what borrowing can entail, the importance of decent household management and so on, those are good things for young people to learn. Personally, I think it would be a great thing if, right across the UK, every British school child had a basic grasp of the tenets of a modern democracy, of politics, of the importance of voting, of what different parts of Parliament did, of what the relationship is between Parliament and the judiciary and so on. Now, that's not saying everyone should do what we call a GCSE, which is the exam typically taken at 16 in British schools. Everybody should have a GCSE in politics. I'm not saying that, but a basic awareness I think would be a good thing. I spend a lot of time talking to school students, and I do a Skype session with school students as well from the Education Centre in Parliament every Monday morning when Parliament's sitting. And I get asked a lot of these questions about the way the political system works, and I'm very happy to answer them and to try to use technology to get out more widely. But wouldn't it be a great thing if the so-called foundation country for democracy, where we pride ourselves on having the mother of parliaments, took pride in telling people about the British parliamentary system and how it works? And we don't actually do so on a concentrated and focused basis. And I think there would be real merit in doing so. I often start by saying, how many of you are interested in politics? And scarcely any hands go up. When I say to people in schools across the country, how many of you care about the job you're going to get when you leave school or college or university? Loads of hands go up. How many of you care that we should have decent health care available to all, regardless of ability to pay? Forest of hands, even amongst young people, most of whom haven't got health problems. How many of you care about our country, the United Kingdom, through DFID and by other means, trying to do its bit to improve the lot of the 1 billion people around the world who eke out an existence? They don't live, they eke out an existence on less than a dollar a day. How many of you care about bettering their lot? There's a massive forest of hands go up, and I always say, well, you say you're not interested in politics, and you're obviously not interested in, and you're often turned off by pejorative attacks and ad hominem attacks, personal abuse, people in suits shouting at each other, the pomposities of politics, and maybe even you're not that interested in the procedures. But as far as the stuff of politics is concerned, a lot of you are very interested. And the second question remain the default position? No, I stand by the view that I've expressed that in legal terms, the default position would be that unless Parliament acted to prevent Brexit, you know, we are scheduled, if there isn't an act to prevent it and there is no extension, we are scheduled to leave on the 31st of October. I'm not counselling that. I'm not agitating for that. I'm not arguing for that. I think that's pretty obvious from what I've said. I'm simply saying that that is the position as I understand it. It may not be the normative view that you hold, but it is the factual position as things stand. The very last question.
It was just on vision sort of for the country, but
the
I country. Think.
Future of the country. There have been some critical questions asked about President Trump. Perhaps I can just say to you, I am absolutely passionate about parliamentary democracy. I am passionate, too, about our worldwide network of relationships. These should not be either or. You don't have to take the attitude that being pro-American means being anti-European, or being pro-European means being anti-American. And our relationship with the Far East is very important. What do I believe? I'm very pro-American. I've always loved the United States. And I think our relationship with the United States should subsist long into the future. It's much bigger than the question of what the record or performance of a particular president in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the noughties, or now might be. That relationship should survive. We believe in democracy. We believe in the rule of law. We believe that on the whole, free enterprise is a better source of wealth creation compatible with human liberty than any other system devised by humankind. And that remains my view. I happen to think that alongside a thriving economy and strong defences in a world of great uncertainty, and to both of those I attach the highest importance, the question of what's in our DNA in terms of the celebration of diversity and respect for equality is writ large. I think that matters. I think, for example, in my own country, that multiracial Britain is much better as a country than we were before we became multiracial Britain. Celebrating a country in which people, irrespective of background, irrespective of colour, irrespective of ethnicity, irrespective of religious affiliation, irrespective of gender, irrespective of sexuality, irrespective of disability, can thrive is incredibly important. And, you know, my vision of the future is a vision in which social mobility is dramatically advanced. And people often talk about the problem, it's a huge global problem of the fight against global poverty, but even within our own countries, there's a huge challenge of social mobility. Now, Harold Wilson, as Prime Minister, used to talk about how poor he was as a kid. And Alec Douglas Hume, his opponent, once famously said, if Harold Wilson went to school with no boots on, it was only because he was too big for them. Now, I don't want to exaggerate and say that I come from a background of grinding poverty. I don't come from a background of grinding poverty, but I went to what you'd call a government school. I went to a state school. I don't have private resources. My wife and I have three kids, all of whom go to a very, very good state schools in London. And I feel very strongly that people should get on the basis of merit and resourcefulness, not on the basis of background, of birth, or special privilege. And I also believe that in any society, there is first of all, everybody in the end depends on public services, and I don't want to be unkind, but under successive governments, for all its faults and failings, I much prefer the British approach to healthcare. If I may say so. I much prefer the British approach to healthcare under governments of both colours. And people in the end, for the big things, they always depend on the public services, particularly in the field of health. And 93% of kids go to state schools, and I spend most of my time going to state schools. And I also think you've got to remember there's a proportion of people who, for whatever reason, can't cope, and they do need a government to help them. And that's incredibly important. I think any country that says, well, you know, the rich shall prosper and the devil take the hindmost, that would be uncivilised. That's not the position taken by the British government or the British opposition. That is not civilised. It should be part of the DNA of a decent society that we keep the best and improve the rest. And we, in particular, ensure that those at the bottom of the pile are protected, are nurtured, and are given a chance. And all too often around the world, I'm not referring to any one country, all too often around the world, ladies and gentlemen, this is the criticism of the performance of modern democracies. That still isn't the case. If you look to those countries in Scandinavia, where the gap between rich and poor is lesser, mental health is superior, the happiness quota is greater, the level of acrimony and dispute is lower. And so I think, you know, let's try to pursue some of those features of the good society, which isn't just about wealth, but about warmth. It's not just about how much you earn, but about what protections and quality of life you enjoy.